This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the play on the show.
From the 425, Paul, you're lucky you didn't have to watch Carlos Silva pitch and Brad Wilkerson with Milton Bradley in the outfield while being told to be excited about signing Sean Figgins.
Exactly. I don't want to ever have to feel that way. I am a spoiled sports fan, and I will not have it any other way.
Meanwhile, our future was sold in a bona fide star, Adam Jones, being traded for a Canadian who couldn't pitch because his shoulder hurts. Yep, that happened too.
Well, didn't a bald eagle land on him once?
No, that's Paxton, man. We love Paxton.
Oh, it's Bedard. Another Canadian.
Yeah, oh. Eric Bedard. Eric Bedard's a Canadian we don't care for. I like Paxton. Paxton's just been unlucky. Bedard was difficult. He was one of the most unlikable players.
Really?
Absolutely unlikable. Yeah.
What about him?
He wouldn't throw more than 100 pitches. So it was like five innings and a dive. And I realize this gets at the threshold of like sort of shaming someone of like, hey, he wasn't tough enough to do it and he had shoulder problems. He's the only player that I've ever seen a team send out a press release for saying that he underwent medical tests that detected no damage.
Ooh, that's never good.
No, where it was basically, look, he had all the tests he wanted, and it didn't look like there was anything wrong, so we're not sure why he's pitching, why he's not pitching.
Pitchers are an interesting breed.
Yeah. It's Danny and Gallant. It's time to get to Brock Heward here for Blue 42.
Here we go. This is Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, GU, corner, half back, flat, on two. Ready, right.
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
I can't read the last text on the Mac and Jack's Brewing Company text line, but it's very, very funny. Morning, Brock. How are you now?
Morning, Paulie. Yes, pitchers.
You remember Guts Bedard?
Oh,
Guts Bedard.
Yeah, Paul, think of even worse body language than Jay Cutler. Truly did not care.
Really didn't care.
Super talented pitcher. You could tell just baseball is a means to an end. It's made me a lot of money because he's incredibly gifted and talented, and his off-speed stuff was just pure filth.
Unbelievable curve.
But honestly, he was worse body language, worse demeanor, worse care than Jay Cutler ever was.
Cutler was tough, too.
Yeah,
his first interview after being acquired, and when the Mariners traded for him, like everybody knew how much they were giving up in Adam Jones. He said, okay, you guys have got five questions. Jim Moore said, why is that? His response was, that's one.
Yeah.
He also left a game. This was after he left the Mariners. Left a game in the fifth inning, despite having not allowed a hit. He had a no-hitter going, and he was like, that's my five. Clock it out. Wow.
Yeah,
cha-ching.
Just very
gone.
Just not your typical Canadian nice. Most Canadians.
I know. He wasn't.
Luke Wilson,
they're
nice.
Supposed to be nice.
Yeah, most. I think most Canadians that have played professionally here in Seattle, really nice. Probably have some Kraken players. Right, and hockey's a little different breed. But, man, the guys that I could think of through the years. And Luke Wilson at the top of it, pretty nice. Not Eric Bedard, not nice.
You have a chance to make history, and you don't go for it. That is unforgivable.
He worked his shift, man. He threw his five innings.
That is unforgivable.
He worked his shift.
Unbelievable.
It's time for him to go home.
I'm actually mad now, but I appreciate the Seattle sports history lesson, guys. So question number one for you, Brock. Nick Saban just got extended through 2028. He's going to be coaching until he's 77 years old. By the way, he's just a month younger than Pete Carroll. Definitely does not look it. That head of hair is looking better and better by the year. But could you see Pete Carroll coaching until he's 72, Brock?
72 or
77? My bad. I can't do math.
77. Man.
Record 73? Is that
Marv Levy?
He's the oldest. It's either 73 or 74.
I think that is doable and realistic, but I'll tell you, man, you talk to anybody, any former player, anybody in that building, anybody that's around there, there is one thing that's not changed with Pete in 12 years, and that is his energy and juice. And you saw it again in the rookie minicamp and some of the OTA footage. He's diving on the field and trying to rip the ball away and going for the ball. And I'm sure that he looks at that and thinks Nick Saban can do it till he's 77. By God, I can do it, and I don't have to recruit 18 to 22-year-olds. I don't have to do this 365 days a year, and I can get on my paddleboard on Lake Washington and over in the islands of Hawaii for some weeks and some days and enjoy my life and enjoy my time. And he is in the exact right spot. I think Nick Saban took a few destinations, right, from Cleveland and the NFL well before then as well, but ultimately up to Michigan State, then down to Baton Rouge. He finally lands in Tuscaloosa, and it is the right fit for him and his family and his kids and grandkids and everybody else. He found the right fit. I think the exact same is said for Pete. As good as USC was and LA was to Pete, I think this locale and Western Washington and Seattle just fits Pete and his beliefs and his DNA as well as anywhere on the planet.
College is different, though, right? Because once you build it, it's easier to maintain. Once you get the factory set up, and that's not to say that Saban's coasting, but it's easier to take that into your golden years than it is an NFL job, right?
You're selecting. He's no longer recruiting.
Right.
Right. There's 130 Division I jobs, 120 have to recruit, 10 to 12 get to select. And he is on the selecting, and he's at the very top of that selecting. And yes, he's not out on the road doing what he was doing earlier on when they were trying to box out Pete Carroll from Julio Jones. He's not having to do that stuff. He's waiting to just kind of close the deal at the end. He's got the biggest, deepest arsenal of analysts and coaches in America. So, yes, Danny, he has totally built it. He's equipped it better than anybody ever has in college football. There's no question about it. But it still is, as far as the calendar goes, still is 365, so much more than the NFL ranks.
Question two. Little sleuthing, Brock. A little sleuthing that I did. I've sussed out the sticking point with Julio Jones was the size of the salary, more so yes. than draft pick compensation. That was the issue for teams that were poking around, and the feeling was there was a little bit of surprise that Tennessee ended up footing the whole bill, and that, hey, that's probably ultimately a win for Atlanta, that they got them to take on the whole freight of that $15.3 million. What can we learn from that when it comes to Seattle's current contracts? Because 2 years ago, Julio Jones would have been the kind of guy that everybody said, yeah, you just cut the check. Like, don't worry about the size of it. Like, that guy's great. You pay him at the top of the receipt. Yeah, well, that contract was a weight by the end of it. What can we learn from that when it comes to Seattle?
Yeah, I think a couple things, Danny. You got your Julio Jones, and his name is DK Metcalf.
Yeah.
And you're going to be paying him well excess of $15 million a year. So you've got that coming, and I know you have expanded cap space, and I know you've got a ton of it, and you don't ever need to really worry or fret or strain about what's to come because that cap is fairly movable. But that I think, is a huge reality. You have some paydays to come. You still don't have Jamal Adams being done, right? And one of the things I think Salky and I are going to discuss in the podcast today is, when do we hear from Jamal? Is he there this week? We know that 70-some players are there. Is he there? I know he's had multiple surgeries, so has he been there the entire time recouping and doing the rehab there, or is it offside? Is he going to be in for the mandatory minicamp next week? Because if he's in for the mandatory minicamp, are they going to even make him available? Or does he want to be made available? I mean, it starts to kind of, temperature starts to rise just a little bit. All of this has been off the radar, rightfully so. Business is business. Taxes is taxes, and you take care of that stuff. But it's going to come to a head here when either he's going to come to mandatory minicamp, or he and his team are going to feel like, hey, man, you know, we're not where we want to be, and this thing's got to get done. So, yeah, for Tennessee to foot $15 million of it, that was probably the end-all, be-all, right? When push came to shove, here's the deals on the table. Here's the draft compensation. I don't think anybody was given a one, so here's a two, here's a four. Let's move this around. Now, how much are you going to take? We'll take all of it. Good. He's yours. And now we'll see if he can pass the physical and become a Titan.
How much better is Tennessee legitimately with him aboard? I mean, that offense looks pretty intimidating with A.J. Brown and with Derrick Henry. You have some of the freakiest athletes in the NFL at three of your most important skill positions. We'll see if Ryan Tannehill can make it still happen without Arthur Smith. Their defense stunk last year.
Yep. Yeah, their offense wasn't the reason they collapsed and didn't finish and didn't go on the run that they did the year before. And yeah, if you've got a Ryan Tannehill, you've got to give him a little bit more help than you do a Russell Wilson, right? I mean, you've got to make sure you've got guys that can separate. He's got a strong arm. I think Ryan throws a pretty good deep ball, and I think that's a facet of what they love to do, that heavy, heavy run game, and here comes a heavy play-action pass off of it. And, man, I think we saw that win a Super Bowl in Seattle way back when, and that's exactly the roots and the DNA that they're going to follow, and we're going to get to see in Week 2 in Seattle.
Question 3. Brock, baseball has a sticky stuff epidemic, at least per Sports Illustrated. It's thought that 80 to 90% of pitchers are using some sort of solution to boost their spin rates.
Interesting.
Some of the descriptions.
Pelican Dip Grip was one of the ones I read. Mixture of pine tar and rosin. Pelican Dip Grip.
This is just gross reading some of this stuff. One baseball had clear enough fingerprints indented in the goo that opponents could mimic the pitcher's grip. It's got me wondering, Brock, you know, in football, I'm sure that there were some sort of potions or other things that you and your teammates might have used, whether it's on the football or it's to stay warm. What was your favorite potion?
Well, I think that the strongest correlation there, Paulie, and where there's probably the most symmetry, is the length that quarterbacks go to get the texture of that football the way they want it. Much like a pitcher, and those guys are using that for grip purposes. It's not Gaylord Perry that's throwing a spitball. It is those guys truly trying to utilize it to get as much grip and spin on a football. And to watch the lengths that some QBs will go to. And back in Indy, Peyton had, and those guys in the equipment room had quite, it was like a six-hour ordeal when those footballs would come from Wilson, come from the factory, all waxed up, and it was sauna, it was scrubbed, it was sauna, it was Mississippi mud, it was, you know, a lot of things that get to a place where that football then becomes exactly the way that Peyton wanted it, exactly the way Marino wanted it, exactly the way Tom Brady wanted it, exactly the way those guys want that grip on the ball. And that's probably, from my experience, I didn't really ever see stick'em. I mean, the gloves were so sticky, Paul, the ones that you used to dominate 7-on-7 up there on Capitol Hill, right? Similar gloves. The big guys up front, you know, would have their jerseys taped, so the shoulder pads would have tape on them. And those John Randall in particular wanted nothing, no skin, no jersey, nothing for those guys to grab. And maybe at times there was, you know, a little lubricant put on the outside as well, so you couldn't get your hands on some of those defensive linemen. So I think it's a little more the defensive linemen, the quarterbacks in the NFL game more than anybody else that they really try to make the most of their equipment.
What was the worst kind of ball for you? Did you want a roughed up? Because I've watched the ball boys as they prepare it, and they've got like buffers, there's sandpaper in there, and there's kind of like to get the waxy sheen off of it. What was the thing you liked most to have in a ball?
Well, we started the segment with pitchers are a weird breed and lefties even more so. So when I was in high school, I liked it right out of it. I liked that wax.
Oh, no kidding.
So, yeah. It was
nobody
really weird,
likes so. That.
No, but I'm weird. And I did in high school, and I had pretty big hands. That was the one benefit. It's usually the guys that have smaller hands that are the ones that are the most particular about their grip and making sure the football feels right and it's deflated or inflated enough. So I was finicky in a lot of other areas. I was difficult, Danny, and demanding in a bunch of ways. But the football wasn't as big a deal to me. Like I just whatever it is. Now there's certain shapes like I hated. Gosh, it was Rawlings that had a really skinny ball that they made, and so I the NFL ball, man, they're and you could ask 100 quarterbacks this, and I think they'll all say the same thing. What is the best ball out there? What's the best ball to throw? Is it Nike? Is it Adidas? Uh-huh. Is it Wilson? What? Oh, it's the NFL ball. Like, it's not even close. That NFL ball. Yeah, it is just, it gets the best leather, it has the most shape, it has the best factories, and there is not a better football on the planet to throw than the Duke.
How often did the center's sweat affect your grip?
Oh, yeah.
That's not Brock so much. I know Brock's brother had an issue with the tuchus of one of his.
Yes.
I Can I share that, or will Trevor Highfield
get mad? I
think
so. Trevor Highfield, oh, he was a sweater. Whew.
Yeah, Trevor Highfield. Would Damon have him change pants at halftime?
At halftime, yeah. Because yeah. It was a big, swampy, soupy mess. Yes. Yeah, you go to slap that button to let him know that you're there, and all of a sudden that just, yeah, spray and sweat. And
swamp.
I covered those teams as a member of the student paper at the UW, and Trevor Highfield, I remember writing a story about him and becoming the center, and what he said was, well, the first time that I played center, I didn't know the quarterback's hands go where well they go.
Yes.
So he was a little bit surprised at the intimacy of the position.
Yes, they do. Hey, by the way, something thrown right back at you guys a little bit. Looking at the Seahawk roster.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just because it's the off season and OTAs and the players finally show up. What are we, mid-June almost, or June 8th? Robert Kimdichie and Alden
Kimdichie.
Smith.
Kimdichie.
Yeah. And Alden Smith.
Yeah.
Both in the 90s. Both on this roster.
Yeah. Let's go.
What?
The comeback begins now, Brock.
Yes. Has there been any update on Alden Smith? Are we going to hear that? Has anybody asked Pete? And I know it's all been so very different this year, but where is that?
About Alden Smith?
No, or Jamal, or Kimdichie, or there's some fascinating, colorful folks on this team in this locker room.
Do you think the fact that Kimdichie fell off a hotel balcony is a concern or an asset?
Because
leading up to the
dude,
draft, that was I mean, that was the one thing you'd look at is like, I don't know about the decision making that led him to fall off the balcony. But on the flip side of it, the fact that he maybe is just not built to be damaged if he's able to withstand and perform after that.
Was it a synthetic strain of something that he was?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was truck stop weed, which everybody should be advised to steer well clear of. That stuff's scary as hell.
Pretty fascinating group here when you look at just the athleticism, man, on that defensive line. Carlos Dunlap and Kerry Hyder, and we'll see where Alden Smith is. We'll see what that all shakes out. We'll see what Kimdichie ultimately looks like. I hope all of those guys are there at OTAs this week. All the hype, obviously, is Russell and Bobby and familiar faces. But man, there's some characters there and some incredible body types and former first round uber talented guys that Pete just can't wait to work with.
It might be similar to the day that I saw Marshawn Lynch, Braylon Edwards, Antonio Bryant, and Kellen Winslow all standing next to each other and thinking to myself, like, yeah, this probably wouldn't have happened if Tim Ruskell was still the GM here.
Nope.
Probably wouldn't have seen this specific lineup of fellas exchanging jerseys with each other.
Don't think so. Brock,
we love talking to you. We'll catch up with you
Brock.
On Thursday.
See you, boys.
That is Brock Heward. He joins us Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays for Blue 42. You can also catch him, the Brock and Salk podcast, which they usually record on these Tuesdays. Brock back this week after his fishing trip to Alaska. What do you make of the sticky stuff in baseball? And there's now, it's become, Sports Illustrated has elevated it and declared it the biggest potential scandal in baseball since steroids. Baseball takes itself too seriously with these things and characterizes it as some sort. I think it's just an interesting question of, hey, is this contributing to the lack of offense in the game? And I think we could all agree it would be better off if you didn't have enhanced. Nobody needs more strikeouts in this game. So if pitchers are getting a boost, we should eliminate the boost that all of them are getting so we can have more hitting.
Yeah. And if they knew about this, then their approach this offseason with the baseballs was a mistake, wasn't it? Where they're deadening the baseballs just slightly?
I'm not convinced they're deadening the baseballs. We're going to need more time to figure out.
Okay.
I know that they've said that and that there's humidors involved and all of that stuff. I don't take anything baseball says at face value about
this. Fair enough. So how about this? Once again, there is something that everyone has been talking about in baseball for years, and now it comes to the forefront, and we're told that baseball's actually going to take care of it, when the last time that they were shown a major cheating scandal, at least the way that they want to frame it, they did nothing except for make some coaches and general managers go away.
Well, not only that, but let's make it clear that they tried to handle it behind the scenes, and the only reason it became public was because Mike Fears, former Astros pitcher who was then with the A's, talked in depth to The Athletic about what was happening, right? It was only when it was dragged out into the light of day that baseball dealt with it in the light of day.
And they might never have dealt with it, period, had it not been brought out into the light of day, to be perfectly honest. So now I guess maybe that's the approach. Hey, we can change the game. But if 80 to 90%, Danny, of pitchers are using it in some capacity, clearly everyone feels that they need to do it to keep up, sort of like with the 90s and steroids where the guys, I don't know if it was 80 to 90%, but I know that there are a lot of guys who probably did it because they felt that they had no choice but to.
First thing, is this different than typical scuffing, use of spitballs? We've seen cheaters be kind of even beloved. Gaylord Perry's in the Hall of Fame, right? Like, notorious spitballer. Like, it's part of his lore. Is this different than that?
Well, I guess I would have to know the content of Gaylord Perry's spitball. I'm assuming.
Oh, man, he'd mess with people in it. There was a time that they talked about a foul ball going off a press box window and leaving a smudge, and he was like, well, I guess it hit a mosquito on the way up. Baseball's rules. And
was it just spit that he was putting on it, or were there other things that were involved with the spit?
There is constant insinuations that he had other stuff that he was using to doctor a baseball.
Well, then that's the answer. If it was all man-made, then I wouldn't have a problem with it. If it was all spit. But yeah, if there's a less than 90% concentration of spit, erroneous. Can't do it.
In the 80s, you had guys have been caught on the mound with sandpaper, other things that you would use. Don Sutton, I believe, had it in his glove one time. There was a pitcher who had an emery board.
It is kind of
funny.
Thing
that you used to. Right. It is funny. And we laugh about it. Is this different than that? Or are we just getting our undies in a bunch over something that's always been part of baseball?
I think the problem is now it has become a widely accepted science. And I think that is where it's gone from being, okay, a couple of guys are doing it to get a little bit of an edge, but not everybody's doing it too. Now, legitimately, everyone is doing it in some way, shape, or form. And if it gets to that point and spin rates have increased and these fastballs are essentially jumping on hitters when they get towards them, then, yeah, it's gone too far.
How do you stop it?
That is an impossible task. That is impossible to deal with. You have to make sure that every single person in the bullpen is up to no funky business. Same thing in the dugout. You have four umpires at a game. Are you going to hire now like an entire detail for every single team that's going to be observing both bullpens, both dugouts, both clubhouses? Think the Players Association is going to accept that? No, there's no way for them to do this.
The best descriptions that in that Sports Illustrated story are one that a foul ball, something that was fouled into a dugout, went in there, and the team that whose dugout it was fouled into could pick up the ball by just laying their palm flat on it. They didn't have to grip it. Like, there was enough tack on the ball that it would stick to the bottom of your hand. Also, one of the pitchers, and it was a National League reliever, I believe, said that when he went through airport security and they swabbed his hands, it lit up as if he had touched explosives. And they said, like, what have you been handling? He's like, well, it's probably not organic, and it had been Pelican Grip Dip, and he insisted he had showered and washed his hands after the game. Do you make the umpires watch a pitcher before he starts throwing? Like, you got to do a COVID-style hand wash. I want to see bubbles in there. You lather it up and wash in. Do we have sinks that they have to scrub into like they're surgeons?
There are so many places to hide it. Glove, hat, shirt, pants, belt, shoe, sock. I mean, there are so many.
Do you make them strip? Do you empower the umpires? Do you give them more search powers?
Pitchers have to pitch naked now. That's the new standard for baseball. They can't do it, Danny. It's not. They have no way to enforce this. And knowing baseball, they won't enforce it because they're cowards. They never enforce this stuff. They act like they have these big teeth. Nope, they are a little chihuahua yapping and acting as if they're going to actually fix the game.
Do you want to see him start just chucking pitchers out of a game? Like, hey, it seems like you're up to no good. You're out of here.
Yeah. That would add some entertainment to the game. That's for sure. And then you'd have temper tantrums. Yeah, let's do it.
It's Danny and Gallant. Shannon Dreyer, our Mariners insider, she's joining us next to talk about the demotion of Jared Kelnick. That's ahead.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
People chiming in, Paul, with different stories. Rick Honeycutt having a thumbtack taped to the inside of his hand. All sorts of different things have been used over the years. I view these things as much... I don't know if you're going to be able to eliminate them. I would say that it seems like more mound checks are just going to delay games even
yes.
more. And Buster Olney has said that would be something. There is something kind of fun about watching umpires check for it, though. In the 86 National League Championship Series, there was a ton of tension over Mike Scott, who was an Astros pitcher, was accused of scuffing balls. He was one of the guys that threw, or first guys to call it, a split finger. And they were constantly asking to look because they felt that he was scuffing baseballs to accentuate the break.
I wish that we'd be able to mic up the umpires so that we could actually hear what takes place when they go out to the mound and the arguments and maybe the attempts at defense that pitchers might try to use to plead their case. Hey, I'm okay. No, it's just sweaty. I'm just a sweaty man.
For the Mariners, they resume today in Detroit with a 3-game series. Jared Kelnick not with the team, having been optioned down to AAA to Tacoma after he's in the midst of an 0-for-38 skid. And as we kind of recalibrate things, we thought it was a great opportunity to bring in our Mariners insider, Shannon Dreher, who is with us here on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Shannon, first of all, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, no problem. Good morning.
With Jared Kelnick's demotion to AAA, I don't think it comes as a surprise given the how long this skid has been. Is how big a disappointment do you think this is for the Mariners, not just for Kelnick himself, but for the team?
I don't think it's hugely a disappointment. I think everybody would have loved to have seen him thrive or at least survive out there, but what the process is, you've seen this before. A lot of young players come up. The majority of them have to go back to AAA to work some things out. And I think that the players in that clubhouse, I think they understand that. I think that they've seen enough of Jared to know that the talent is there, that the approach is there, that, you know, he has the look of a guy that is going to be, I think, everything that everybody expects him to be somewhere down the road, but it doesn't happen automatically. So I think if you're a teammate, I think that there's a lot of understanding there. Taylor Trammell talked quite a bit about how, you know, tough it is and learning at that level and everything that they go through, and it's a process and you just have to get through it. He talked about that over the weekend. If you're the Mariners, if you're player development, if you're Jerry DePoto, I think they probably looked at this. While it would have been nice if he, you know, came up and was able to help the team win ball games all at once, they probably also looked at this as an opportunity to figure out what more he needs to do and what they can do to help him get there. You know, let's not forget that for the longest time, Jerry DePoto was insistent that he needed some significant time in the minors before getting the call up. So I think especially this year with the divide between AAA and big league baseball, the pitching is just different right now, and thus making it tougher on the younger players that are coming up. I think that there's no other way other than to actually see it to prepare for it. And he just simply wasn't able to make the adjustments while he was up. Now he can go down to AAA, take that deep breath, kind of analyze what he did, what he needs to do. And then I think that if he comes back a second time and you see something similar, I think that's when there's concern.
What is it you think he needs to do at that AAA level then? And you highlighted some of it. How long, too, do you think it would take for him to potentially prove that he'd be ready to come back in the same way that we saw with Trammell?
I think you want to give him a little bit more time now. I think that you want to, you know, it's funny. I mean, one of the things that they have said for a long time, for 2 years, I can think back in 2019 when this was talked about, was they wanted him to have the opportunity to fail, and they wanted to see him be able to work out of a struggle. And that never happened while he was in the minor leagues. That certainly happened while he was at the big leagues. And what we didn't see is we didn't see him work out of that struggle. So, you know, I think that there are some things that, you know, there's no guarantee that he will struggle. He could go back to AAA and hit everything. I think that obviously the pitching is not the same, but in talking to Jake Fraley last week as well, he said that you can get pockets of pitchers that pitch, you know, they have pitched in the big leagues. They do pitch you like you're in the big leagues, and that's different. And, you know, that helped him get ready for his call up after being injured. But I think with Kelnick, I think you need more time to give him that opportunity. If it happens, great. If it doesn't, at least at that point, he's seeing some more lefties. I think some of the guys he will recognize now when they pitch him like they pitched him in the big leagues. And I think the other thing is that I'm really curious to see what happens here is, you know, talk quite a bit about you don't want to take the emotion, you don't want to take the bravado away from Jared Kelnick. That's who he is, but I am kind of curious to see how they handled that in game. You know, he did get kind of fired up after a lot of strikeouts. He did show a lot of emotion out there. And at what point is that detrimental? Did he cross that line? And is that something that they need to go to work on? Does he need to relax a little bit more? We saw Scott Servais trying to relax him in game a couple of times too. So I'm wondering if that, you know, along with, okay, if they're coming inside and be looking for an outside breaking ball or changeup, you know, I wonder how much they also go to work on. You've got to put that last at bat behind you.
We're talking to Shannon Dreher here, our Mariners insider. The other piece of news that's been a real disappointment is the injury to Kyle Lewis. And we don't have a great timeline on when he'll be back, but Jerry DePoto indicating last week it's probably not going to be anytime soon. Shannon, I've been listening to Paul Wine all morning about how much longer it's going to take. He's been complaining and saying he feels like the rebuild is now pushed down the road a year. Does this take a little bit of wind out of the sails about some of the momentum that this young core was putting together?
I don't think so. And I think that if we look at this season, it's been every time something has gone wrong, everybody just falls off the cliff. Mm-hmm. You lose three games, you lose five games, it's all over. And then they come back and have four game sweeps. You know, they did bounce back from San Diego. They did bounce back all April, all May. Let's take a deep breath and just see what happens the remainder of the season. You've got 4 months to go. And in that 4 months, you've got the opportunity to see guys take steps forward. I think that we are seeing it a little bit here and there. Look at Logan Gilbert. Look at his first two starts. And, you know, for me, I was a little bit panicked. This didn't look like what I thought I was going to see. Well, look at his last two starts. Started to pick it up in start three and start four. I think you saw him take a significant step forward with still a lot of room to go, but he's moving in that direction. I think that with a lot of the younger players, you're going to have that opportunity. Now, it's also going to get tougher in that, and Mike Flowers, just, I've got a post up on 710sports.com right now about it, illustrated it beautifully in a roundtable, the pregame roundtable or postgame that we had, in that it's going to get a little crazy for these young players. None of them. I mean, your Kyle Seager, Mitch Haniger, Tom Murphy's, and Dylan Moore's are the only ones who have played an entire 162 season. J.P. Crawford hasn't done it. Ty France hasn't done it. And then, of course, all the call-ups haven't done it. The minor league season is shorter. It's different. And he said that the first time he did it, getting to the end of the year, he lost 20 pounds. Physically, mentally, he was spent. These guys are going to go through that. This is a different pressure that's on them this year. There is a pressure to win at this level. And then the other little surprise will be when they get into August and September, the teams that are contending, they look totally different. And that will hit them like a ton of bricks when all of a sudden other teams have really upped their game and the push that they're going to make. And these are just things to look forward to or look for. You know, they could be absolutely cruising the next 2 months and it could get rocky again, and then they could pick it up again in September. So as far as the entire thing goes, Kyle Lewis is a concern. But I don't think that you were banking on every single player that you had to hit on all of them. It would be foolish to do that because that never happens. So, you know, you hope for Kyle Lewis's sake that this is not something that is going to be career long or career altering. That's the scary thing right there for me. But as far as the other injuries go, I think you still have a good opportunity to get a number of these guys the experience that they need, and more importantly, taking those steps forward. So I'm not ready to say at this point, oh yeah, this is going to push it all back further.
Hear that, Paul? No more whining. You listen to Shannon Dreher. If you won't listen to me, listen to our Mariners insider, Shannon Dreher. Shannon, we really appreciate your
Thanks,
time.
Shannon.
We look forward to catching up with you soon.
Anytime, guys.
All right. It is Danny and Gallant. We're going to have another baseball insider. Larry Stone's going to join us top of the hour. But first, we'll sort through what Shannon just told us about Jared Kelnick and what we should expect going forward. That's ahead.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
We just spoke with Shannon Dreyer, Mariners beat reporter for 710sports.com. You can check out that podcast on the Danny and Gallant podcast. Danny, what we found most interesting from our conversation with Shannon has to do with Jared Kelnick and his stint in the minors, likely going to be a longer one than that of Taylor Trammell.
Yeah, she seems to think that there is more that they're going to have him work on, that this is not a matter of just rebuilding confidence, that that's someone who had basically a week's worth of experience at the AAA level, and this is as much an opportunity for him to reset. And she brought up the idea that there's probably more work to be done there, and that Kelnick might be a little bit further away, that it's not just the results, that there's some things they'd like to see him modify.
Right, and when you see him having the kind of expressions of frustration and
he said
anger,
bad words,
outbursts.
He cursed. Multiple F-bombs dropped after strikeouts.
Do you have a problem with that? Because I'm surprised by the amount of people that do. I will say, as somebody, again, this is for anyone who plays sports. Like I'm talking even golf. I get very mad at myself when I do something poor in a game of sports. And I will generally yell at myself or swear. Is that bad? Doesn't that show that you care? Doesn't that show that you want to be better? I mean, maybe there's fake hustle, as you have talked about before, Danny, but I have no issue with Kelnick's anger after these bad at-bats.
It's not a matter of etiquette. This isn't him having bad manners or saying bad words where kids can hear or it looking bad. The question is, does that impede your ability to succeed the next time out there? And there's a school of thought that is found when you look at and study performance. Jerry will talk to us about keeping your heart rate low. Like, it's something they measure and something they study, right? And one of those things of looking at is, hey, you perform best not when you're under stress or under tension. You perform at your best when you're in a calm and not relaxed, because it's not like you want to be sleepy, but that you're able to control, that you're not on alert. And I think that would be the question of, are those expressions of frustration something that's carrying over into the next at bat? Is it causing stress for him? If it's just a release and he's sort of rinse, lather, and repeat and is ready to go, I don't think there's an issue. I don't think this is a matter about etiquette. I think this is a matter about performance. And maybe the frustrations that he's expressing are actually becoming an impediment toward him having success the next time up.
I definitely think that there is something to that. And I'll just say, as somebody who at a young age was really bad, when I had outbursts of anger, they felt at times uncontrollable. As time has gone on, I have gotten better with it, and I learned to manage it. But I know at a younger age, totally different just 10 years ago than where I'm at right now. Kelnick is 21 years old. So I can totally see how that is something that maybe sticks with him and does it ultimately affect the process.
Yeah, and he's never experienced prolonged failure before. And Shannon said it. The whole point of development is you push a prospect to the point of failure and you watch how they learn and adjust and recover from that. Well, guess what? They pushed him through the minor league level and he never experienced that extended period of failure. The biggest frustration he had was that he wasn't promoted to the big league sooner. And now he's experienced sustained, prolonged failure. And what do you learn from that? How do you learn to get out of it? Is the expression of frustration sort of a sign that he is becoming more and more pent up, that he is becoming more and more tightly wound, that he's pressing? Baseball players have all types. He's gripping the bat too tight. You're pressing at the plate. You start swinging. Now, for the most part, he wasn't swinging. A lot of times that manifests itself in swinging at pitches that aren't strikes.
Yeah.
That wasn't so much. It didn't seem like that was. Kelnick was still drawing his walks. So I don't think that was necessarily it. But is the frustration, and is that something that they want to get him to work with to understand that, hey, we get the frustration, but you're better off not feeling that because it gets in the way of the success you might have the next time up.
I mean, that legitimately might be just as important as his approach at the plate. His stint in the minors, maybe that's what it is. Text in, learn to control it in public. I think that's a fair point.
See, I don't care about the public part. I really don't. And I don't think that this is about how it... I don't think this has anything to do with how it looks. There are tons of guys... I mean, people have broken bats. Baseball players have broken bats for years.
Listen, I'm not saying every single time that you need to hide it. But that's the first step, isn't it? Isn't that the first step as far as being able to control thyself in that moment?
It depends on whether it's going to work for him. And I think that's part of the discovery process.
You have to figure it out. Right. You have to figure it out at that
point. Is this going to work for him? Because maybe there's nothing to do that his expression of frustration has absolutely zero to do with the fact that he's gone 38 straight at bats without a hit. That's we're talking about a symptom and describing it as a cause. And he is going to be someone who is tightly wound and who does freak out. And that's fine. But I don't think we know that. In part because we've never seen him experience sustained failure before. So there's a part of a learning process.
And as a texter says, why get so worked up when it is expected that you will often fail? Not by him. And this is new. This is entirely new territory for him. It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle.
Swearing helps you perform better. It's scientific.
I see this article that they clicked.
I'm encouraged by that. If my mom was still alive, I might send that to her and explain that this would explain a lot of the different why I took a healthy approach to my competitive competitive swearing.
The subheading on this article does read, sometimes you can't help blurting out a four-letter word during a tough workout, but it can actually help you see results at the gym. Still, though, you got to keep it a little bit close to the vest, I would imagine. So Seahawks are back at OTAs, Danny. Interesting comments made by Brady Henderson about this Seahawks offense and just how different it looks yesterday. Here's what Brady Henderson had to say.
It's maybe the importance of those OTAs is maybe heightened a little bit when you're installing a new offense like they are.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bigger deal for the offensive guys who are learning we don't really know exactly what that system is going to look like, but from what I understand, they are going all in on the Waldron system, and I don't think it's going to be like it was 3 years ago when they hired Brian Schottenheimer, and they basically made Schottenheimer adopt most of what they were already doing.
I think that is noteworthy. So, just how different could you envision this Seahawks offense being? We'll touch on that in just a moment. It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle.